Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Peru Postpartum Politics Conference Call. At this time, all lines are in the listen-only mode, but following the presentations, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. And if at any time during this call you require immediate operator assistance, please press star followed by zero. Note that the call is being recorded on Wednesday, January 17th, 2018. And I would like to turn the conference over to CCA President Kenneth Frankel. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Sylvia, and thank you for the explanation. The format of today's event, and thank you all for joining us for this very important event, particularly for in Peru, but for a country that's very important for Canada and the hemisphere, which is Peru. The format for today's event is we'll have an open discussion amongst the panelists that we will moderate, and then we will open it up for questions from all of the people who are listening, and will be queued. Sylvia will come back on and explain how it is that you can make questions if you would like to. I think to get this started, although I know people on the call are very knowledgeable about Peru, but I think it might be useful let me introduce today's panelists. My mistake. First one is Alonso Gurmende, who's a professor of international law at the Universidad del Pacífico. Paulo Ugaz, who's the correspondent for ABSA, which is one of the leading Spanish publications. And Max Cameron, professor of political science at the University of British Columbia and undoubtedly Canada's best scholar on all things related to Peru. So with that introduction, I'd like to ask Alonso if he could... Oh, hello, Alonso, are you still on the phone?
I got dropped, but I'm back.
Okay, you're back. Okay, Alonso, perhaps you could start off by just giving us a little bit of the background as to how we got into this situation in Peru.
Right, perfect. So maybe I should backtrack a little bit to explain the situation. This whole situation relates to the efforts by Fujimori and his supporters, Fujimoristas, to get him back to Peru after he left power. I think that's the main story behind the scenes. So Fujimori, as I'm sure everyone knows, renounced the presidency and fled to Japan after his rule. And in 2006, about 5 years after he left, he started to want to return. He went to Chile, he was imprisoned, and he was extradited to Peru, where he was sentenced to 25 years jail time for his involvement in the Barrios Altos massacre, La Cantuta massacre. And so the plan became, how do Fujimoristas free him? So in 2009, they started to prepare for the 2011 elections, and they lost. The Keiko Fujimori's daughter, lost the election and started this plan as a reaction, since she was no longer president, she was not going to be president, to seek a pardon of Fujimori. And Keiko applied for the presidency again in 2016. She also lost, as I'm sure everyone knows. And the idea of the pardon is that because Fujimori is in jail for gross human rights violations that are considered, at least under international law, there's some debate on this under domestic law that I'm sure we will go into further later, crimes against humanity, a pardon is not really legal unless it is done for some overarching reason, like, for example, humanitarian reasons. So Fujimori was in jail, and Fujimoristas wanted to ask for his humanitarian pardon. And they get to 2016 with a very large majority in Congress, and they start to govern, to boycott, to use a strong word, PPK, Kuczynski's agenda. And with the hopes of being able to use this as a means to get a pardon, or so it seems. And so at some point, during the Lava Jato corruption scandal investigations, documentation surfaced saying that PPK had not created a blind trust for his dealings with the Odebrecht companies back when he was a minister in the early 2000s. And they accused him of, the Congress accused him of lying to Congress, saying that he had had dealings with Odebrecht, even though he had said he didn't. So they started impeachment procedures. Under rather specious claims, it was not really a very clear case that the law had been breached. It was similar to the Brazilian experience in 2016. So it seemed that everything was lost. Fujimori was PPK was going to be impeached, and there was going to be a political crisis. But in the last minute, Keiko's brother, Kenji, rallies 10 congressmen, 10 votes, exactly the amount of votes PPK needed to survive the impeachment, and vote against the impeachment motion, and saves PPK. So everyone was wondering why. Is it a competition between the Fujimori brothers? Is it a scheme? What is going on? And 3 days later, after this happened, this was December 21st, 3 days later, it was Christmas Eve, December 24th, Fujimori gets a pardon, a humanitarian pardon. So there's a lot of speculation, well-founded speculation, that the pardon was a barter between Fujimoristas from the Keiko side who wanted to, the Kenji side, who wanted to get credit for the pardon, and PPK wanted to survive the impeachment, so that the humanitarian reasoning behind this was not really that clear, it wasn't true. And so now we're left with a government that is a little bit abandoned by everyone. The left wing feels betrayed. He has not guaranteed an alliance with Keiko's part of the Fujimorista party. Kenji is not exactly, he has 10 congressmen. And we in Peru are left wondering what will happen next, now that given the human rights implications, the Inter-American Court is going to evaluate this next February 2nd, whether that pardon was legal or not. So that's basically where we stand right now. I try to summarize this very quickly.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alonso. Max or Pau, are there any other facts or kinds of matters that in the account that you think we should touch upon or that maybe should be brought out and highlighted before we move on?
No, Max? I think that was an excellent summary by Alonso and puts the key facts on the table. I would just add by way of context, the fact that Peru has now, since 2001, had three successful transfers of power from one civilian government to another, and this has been over a period of fairly remarkable economic growth. And so it is, I think, quite surprising to see a country that at this point is experiencing such difficulties where democracy seems as precarious as it is. But I think Alonso has given us some of the elements to understand that. The election in 2016, which did involve the disqualification of a couple of other candidates that could very well have been stronger than Kuczynski, resulted in a first round in which Keiko Fujimori won 40% of the vote straight up, but then lost in the second round by about 40,000 votes. So very, very thin margin, and much of the support for Kuczynski was precisely to stop Keiko Fujimori from coming to power. But the reality, as Alonso notes, is that the Fujimoristas have a majority in the Congress. That's the underlying reality of the country today. It really remains the only viable, strong political party in Peru, which I guess is also a bit of an historical irony in the sense that one of the consequences of Fujimori's government from 1990 to 2000 was really to weaken the political parties in Peru. I wrote a paper with Steve Levitsky a number of years ago called Democracy Without Parties, which was looking at can you actually sustain democratic government in the absence of political parties. Well, the reality is that since we wrote that article in around 2003, political parties have really not been able to reconstitute themselves, and in very little investment has actually been made in party organization. We still go into elections with a plethora of independent candidates. Now we're seeing all of the political parties divided, including the Fujimorista group in Congress, precisely over this issue of the pardon. And I think that the pardoning of Fujimori is not just a question of what to do with this former former leader who was imprisoned for on charges of violations of human rights and corruption. It's the releasing of him really changes the political landscape in Peru. He is, again, a political actor. I'm not saying that he is an aspirant to elective office, but his release really, I think, does acknowledge and reinforce the power that Fujimorismo has in contemporary Peruvian politics. And so while it would be tempting to frame what's happening as here is yet another erosion of democracy in Latin America, it's also, I think, a recognition of the reality, two realities. One, the ongoing and present power of the Fujimorista political party, but also, secondly, the ongoing struggles against corruption and impunity, which, after all, it's the charges against both Keiko and Kuczynski of having taken money from Odebrecht, which has unleashed this unprecedented power struggle.
Thank you, Max. Just following up on that, Pau, it would seem that all the Fujimoristas, I mean, in a naive way, would think, well, that's great because the Patriarcho has been liberated from jail, yet, as Alonso alluded to and Max discussed even more specifically, there is a lot of turmoil amongst the Fujimoristas. And the question we have is, what do you think that means? And do you think, what are the divisions among them? And how might that affect their ability to serve as, well, effectively, it's the opposition party, but obviously a major party. How will that affect their ability to govern and conduct their political party affairs in the Congress and elsewhere?
Well, hi, everybody. I think PPK, as you know, in Peru, has made a deal with the devil, and he has to. He's a very weak president because his fate is joined to Kenji Fujimori, the younger kid of Alberto Fujimori, the dictator of Peru. So, in this moment, the government has to respond to the Inter-American Inter-American Court of Human Rights in February the 2nd, and has to answer about all the reasons that sustains the pardon of Fujimori. And in this moment, they don't have the information enough to answer that question, and they deny the information in Peru to the victims, to the family, to the relative of the victims, and to the Inter-American court. So first, they have to answer to the human rights organization. In the second, he has to answer to Keiko Fujimori and the supporters in the parliament, because they said that this the pardon of his father is a part of corruption. And he said to the supporters that she's happy that his father is released, but she's not happy about the way how he was released. how he's waiting in this moment any mistake of Kenji Fujimori and Pepeta, and her next move could be a checkmate to Pepeta.
Well, is it, I guess, so then the question following up on that, Paula, for the other panelists as well, what does it look like if the deal was made between Pepeka and Kenji? Is that a sustainable alliance that will allow the government to push through the legislation that it would like to push through, and we can have a discussion about, you know, what those major pieces are? Is that a realistic alliance, or is that something that's short-lived and can't sustain itself for the next, you know, several years of the Pepeka government? Do you have a thought about that, Alonso?
Well,
or Pau? Go ahead, either one.
Oh, well, I think there is nothing sustainable in Peru right now. But I think Kenji and his father, Alberto, are very grateful with Pepeka about the pardon. But I think nothing in Peru now depends on PPK. I think he's very weak right now, so we don't know yet that he will end his government, and we don't know what will happen in the next month, because in Brazil, the Lava Jato case, he will release a lot of information about the ex-president and Kuczynski. So we don't know what could happen about that with the government of Kuczynski.
So in other words, he may have survived this one impeachment process, but there may be more information coming out, and the whole issue will be opened up again. Alonso, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yes, I agree with Paula. The thing here is that you asked about if the deal is sustainable, if governments in the country will be sustainable. It also depends on what Pepeka is now, because Pepeka was elected as, yes, with a big support from the progressive left that didn't want Fujimori to be in power. But at the same time, he represented a schism in Peru's right wing as well. Given the clear chance between a conservative and someone who allegedly had more liberal values, right wing in Peru divided, the conservative right for Keiko and the liberal right for PPK. But now with this deal, PPK doesn't really represent liberal values anymore. He doesn't seem to. He's appointed some ministers that don't exactly match to the kinds of things that he would promise. So he's trying to go a little bit more into the side of the Fujimorista policies. And that is something that's going to make all of his base disappear, both the liberal right and the progressive left. But I don't think I agree with Paul when she says that it is very unlikely that conservative right will actually go to his side and to his support. So my problem here is that he has left the Peruvian political spectrum completely divided, and he has no allies. So when he talks about this being a measure of reconciliation, it's more a measure of being left alone. And I don't see that as sustainable, considering what Donna said, right, that the more information is coming.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think he's lost support not only from the left, which contributed to the construction of his electoral majority in the second round, but also the support of many liberal Democrats, his own caucus. He's had until now a reputation for representing economic orthodoxy, but in the context of, you know, someone who seemed relatively untarnished by the scandals of the past, and yet now he's implicated doubly in the corruption of Odebrecht and having pardoned Fujimori in those human rights abuses of the past that isolates him. And hence the extraordinary effort to talk about the construction of a cabinet of reconciliation and all of this rhetoric of forgiveness and turning the page and moving on, and we are pardoning Fujimori for humanitarian reasons and so forth. The reality of that is, of course, that there's no spirit of reconciliation within Fujimorismo. There's never been a willingness to acknowledge the crimes and the abuses of the past in any real sense, and to come to terms with the truth about the past. This is reconciliation rhetoric being used really to say it's time to bring Fujimorismo into the mainstream and to try to construct a governing coalition in which the fundamental prop of PPK is now Fujimorismo. In some sense, that's an acknowledgement of the reality of the Congress and the power of Fujimorismo, and it is worth saying Peru continues to be polarized on these issues. On the one hand, you have massive protests, not only in Lima, but across the country in regions that were affected by the conflict in particular. I think it's quite notable how strong the protests have been in the regions. That shows that there is still the fundamental cleavage in the country today is Fujimorismo, anti-Fujimorismo. And this is now going to be a government that's going to say, well, enough of the antis, enough of the negativity, let's move on. And there is a spectrum of public opinion that's behind that. I mean, I think it has to be said that, that quite frankly, I suspect that, that the majority of Peruvians would have welcomed a pardon under the right conditions. What's right. wrong about this pardon is that even though it is presented as humanitarian, the clear reality is this was part of a deal to win Kenji's support and the support of the people around Kenji to have Fujimori released in return for their support to survive an impeachment proceeding. So it's anything but a humanitarian pardon, and I think it's the way in which the pardon was constructed that actually undoes the argument for it, and the fact that I think Pedro Pablo Kuczynski lied in the most transparent, self-evident way over this right up until the pardon itself about his intentions. Again, I think diminishes his moral authority to govern. So I agree that the situation is actually quite precarious for him.
Well, if I can add one thing, this is shown by the polls, because before the pardon, 66% of the Peruvian population supported Fujimori's pardon. After the pardon, immediately after, the numbers went down so much as to 52 or 53%, if I remember correctly. And the government is so lacking in legitimacy that now that the Pope is visiting Peru, it is a very clear, concerted effort to try to funnel a little bit of legitimacy from the Pope to the government.
Okay. Now let's take it from that level to a more concrete level and specific items that would be in PPK's governing agenda, the economic policy, other issues that he and perhaps other Peruvians think need to be addressed. Maybe, Paola, maybe you could talk a little bit, all of you could talk about, I'll start with Paola. With regard to specific items, the economic policy or other ones that you can identify, how will this play out now? Will nothing happen at all, or will there be certain ways that everybody can agree that certain issues should be moved forward and they can work together on certain specific things?
Well, I think the damage is done in Peru in all the ways, because we live after the pardon like in a charade, because everybody talks about reconciliation, everybody talks, and the president, I think, lied openly, as says our other panelists, and it's much in all of all of the layers of our society, and I think economy is going to be the, we could feel the damage in this way, because the trust in the other, in the between the right and the left, or the moderate right and the moderate left, is done. Nobody trusts in nobody, and when if PPK government fall, we don't know what could happen, because we don't have leaders that we will trust in the future, because a president lied to all the country, and the prime minister lied too. So I think it will be a damage that we can, I don't know, have a special accountability to know how deep it will be the damage. But I think the damage is done, and we, I don't know where in which date this damage will end. I don't know. I don't see in the future a leader in the right or a leader in the left in politics talk to each other and trust to each other. And I don't know if how do you say panorama in English?
Right. I don't know.
I'm not optimistic about the future, because we have a weak president, and I think he's so weak that he will in these days with the visit of the Pope Francisco, he will go with him in every department he will go, because he needs him. He needs him to gain more popularity. Now he has 20% in the polls, in the last polls. So I think the future of PPK and Peru is dark in the moment.
Thank you, Pau. So Alonso, does that mean that Peru is at a standstill right now? Nothing can move. There's no agenda that can be moved through Congress. No items that can be addressed. Is it everybody's just sitting and waiting around to see when the next big political event is going to happen and what the results of that will be?
Well, for the immediate future, I think the government is in damage control mode. They're trying to gain popularity, as Paul says, from the Pope's visits, settle the waters a little bit. As for the things that will move forward eventually, like in a few weeks or months, I think economically, for example, there are a few things that we need to understand in terms of context. The first year of PPK was not a good economic year. The government itself, and not related to Fujimori at all, recognized that the tax reform had been bad. They apologized for reducing growth in the country. And that was coupled with two very strong, we say in Peru, external shocks. One was the El Nino phenomenon that affected large swaths of the northern coast, and to this day we need reconstructions, we need more money, but we collect less money because of the tax reform, but we need to spend more money to fix the El Nino crisis. And then also the impact of Odebrecht, that is the main construction company that had ties to all the construction companies in the country. And so we have less money. We need to build things to reconstruct the north, but we don't have construction companies that are able to operate. That in itself is a little bit of a problem that the government will have to solve. And I would like to think, trying to be a little bit optimistic here, that that is one front where something might be able to be negotiated, although there is right now a lot of conflict regarding a specific law that deals with how to deal with the Peruvian companies, construction companies that dealt with Odebrecht contracts. So we'll see how that generates. But that is something that hopefully will, it needs immediate fixing. And the other thing is that it all depends, again, what PPK is going to do as for who is he going to represent. Is he going to represent the Liberal Democrats, or is he going to represent Fujimoristas? Because social policy might change. He already appointed the first battle of his government was about the ministry of education and the policy for education in the country, particularly around this concept of gender ideology, quote-unquote gender ideology in the country, where conservative groups don't want issues like equal marriage for same-sex couples or sexual education or trans rights to be regulated by Peruvian law. And so he already removed, his education minister was impeached and he was replaced by another one, perhaps less enthusiastic about these topics of gender identity and stuff like that. So these social issues, if PPK veers a little bit more to the right, those might move forward as a way to befriend Fujimoristas. And that is something that concerns me as a human rights scholar. It concerns me greatly, considering the context where the Inter-American Court has already said that governments in Latin America should veer towards regulating equal marriage, for example.
Max, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think, you know, if you look back over the past couple of decades, Peru has, the politics in Peru have been the politics of administration rather than programmatic alternatives. People have talked about government in Peru as government by autopilot. If you think about the Toledo, the Garcia, the Humala, and the current governments, though they campaigned on very different kinds of programs or ideologies, in fact, in office, they've tended to govern in ways that were remarkably similar in the sense that there is a very strong consensus around the basic neoliberal economic orthodoxy that goes back to the Fujimori period. And indeed, Kuczynski himself, his company, Westfield, was created in 1992 at the time of the privatizations that were undertaken by the Fujimori government. So he himself represents no big difference with the Fujimoristas with regard to the economic model. I mean, one could look at things like what does this mean for investor confidence? How will consumers react to the perception of the degree of political uncertainty? How does this affect social protests? Things like that. I certainly think that this is very consequential in terms of the construction of a state or the rule of law. So I worry about what a growing alliance between the Fujimoristas in Congress and the executive would mean for corruption, for the rule of law, and for human rights. But perhaps where we see the greatest potential change in terms of the immediate effect on policy would be in the international arena. Kuczynski has been very strong in his criticisms of Venezuela. And I see him as being so weakened domestically that is no longer going to be credible. And I think it's quite interesting to note that there will be an OAS Summit of the Americas in April, and the theme is democratic governance against corruption. I think this is, you know, going to be rather ironic that the OAS is going to be held in the context of what we're seeing, which is a reversal of democratic governance and is a consequence of corruption. So I think internationally, this is a government that's quite clearly hobbled.
Well, yeah, we're going to come to the international thing. And clearly, you know, the Group of Lima is named after, you know, from the city Lima. In terms of the criticism of Venezuela, and so do you have a sense that Peru has lost that mantle of legitimacy to be active in that, or life will go on and it will continue to take a leadership and be seen to take one of the leadership roles in the hemisphere?
Yeah, you know, I think at a time of a really dire crisis in Venezuela, it's critical to construct a context internationally through multilateral institutions around the need to get Venezuela back on track through free and fair elections and negotiation. But to do that, you have to have credibility on those issues. And Peru, for a while, looked like a country that was on track, at least in the sense that there was a high degree of sort of predictability in its economics, and that politically we were seeing free and fair elections, and the country seemed to be moving in a positive direction. But I think what this does is to really raise some fundamental questions, not just about the current scandal, but also the deeper problems of governance that Peru has that really tarnish it as any sort of model for other countries to look toward. And I think those problems are deeper than the current scandal or the pardoning of Fujimori, but that shines a real spotlight on those deeper problems.
Thank you, Max. It sort of leads to the question, which sort of domestic plus international, and the economic arena, for example, is the Pacific Alliance, which Peru obviously was a big supporter. In fact, President Garcia would say, and others as well, that he was sort of the originator of the idea. Might there be any changes or any fallout with respect to Peru's support for the Pacific Alliance and going forward? That's for Paulo or Alonso, if either one wants to comment on that.
Well, I'll make a short comment about that. I think the Pacific Alliance's main lines of talking points is that it is not meant to be ideological, but rather an alliance of like-minded countries with regards to what is the path to development. The Pacific Alliance is a reaction to the problems of the Andean community, where basically it was Ecuador and Bolivia going for protectionism and Peru and Colombia going for free trade. So to overcome that, they made the Pacific Alliance mostly revolving around economic issues. So I don't think that the Pacific Alliance will have a lot of action with human rights related issues, such as the pardoning of Fujimori. And I don't think that the countries involved would want to bring it up in that context. Maybe in other contexts for sure. As Max said, the Group of Lima might see a loss of legitimacy on part of Peru, and other countries might be willing to take a more predominant role, including Canada, but that is to be seen. The Pacific Alliance, I don't think, will suffer too much. I think at the international level, the main forum will be either in the field of politics with the United States and, for example, what United States politicians say about this and what pressure they're able to exert, and the Inter-American Human Rights System.
How? What's the view from Europe on what's going on in Peru and in Spain? What are you hearing there?
Well, my editor in Madrid is amazed by the fact of the country that was a host of an event to raise the ears about Venezuela. Now we are causing a lot of problems similar than Venezuela, because part of the government wants to go out of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and about corruption. I think we have a lot of issues about transparency in all of the information around pardon of Fujimori. So the government denies the right to know how and when they sustain the pardon of Fujimori. So it's an irony that Peru has to go backwards in that matter. After all that happened in Peru in 2000 with Fujimori.
Okay, thank you. Maybe I just at this point ask Sylvie, the operator, if she could ask people if they have any questions, to give the instructions so that they can queue their questions, and we'll continue having this conversation and then take questions when they have queued up. So, Sylvie, maybe you could give out that information, please.
Certainly, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star followed by one on your touch-tone phone. Questions will be taken in the order received, and if you decide you would like to request to withdraw your request, you will need to press star followed by two. And we ask that if you're using a speakerphone to please lift the handset first. Again, it is star one should you wish to register for a question.
Okay, thank you. We'll come back, Sylvie, we'll come back to you after this question to see if we have any questions that have been queued. Let's take this at short, medium, and long term. If you're looking at it in the short term, what are you looking for to happen? What might happen over the course of the next month? Of course, within about 2 months' time, the hemisphere is going to be in Lima for the Summit of the Americas. And as we know, the theme of the Summit of the Americas is corruption. And as we also know, the corruption is a huge issue playing out in the hemisphere, and it's playing out very strongly in elections throughout the hemisphere this year. So, Max, what do you think we should be looking for? Something that could change the calculus over the, let's say, the next 30 days and maybe over the next 60 days. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I am struck by the similarities with Brazil, where we had a democratically elected president impeached midterm by a Congress seeking to prevent further investigations into their corrupt practices. And there's something sort of similar going on here with Keiko clearly motivated to avoid investigations of her receiving money from Odebrecht, going after Pepe Ka, successfully hobbling him, and then creating the concern that these investigations will be unable to proceed further. In the short term, I think one of the things that fascinates me will be, is a presidential pardon and grace a prerogative of the executive that cannot be overturned, or will it be the view of the Inter-American Human Rights Court that, in fact, given the nature of those crimes, to preclude further investigation and to pardon in a highly irregular manner a former leader is in fact a violation of international human rights norms. I think that's going to be a fascinating question to watch because we don't have many precedents for this.
Alonso, but that would take a while to work through the system, would it not?
Not really, because given that this the Fujimori pardon is for the Barrio Altos massacre, Barrio Altos is a case that already went through all that long-standing, long process that the Inter-American system has. Judgment for Barrio Altos came from the court in 2001. So what the court is going to do now is not going to start a case anew. What they're going to do is the Inter-American Court of Human Rights is the only human rights system that has this monitoring of compliance system that is non-political. So the court itself determines when countries have complied with its judgment or not. So what the court has done is they have summoned the Peruvian government to a hearing on February 2nd. So you were saying what's the first thing that's going to happen in 30 days? In less than 30 days, we're going to have that hearing. And what the court is going to do is basically see what the court ordered Peru in the Barrio Altos case and whether the pardon complied with that or not. And I can say, like having studied this question, it is 99.9% chance that they will say that there is a violation of Peruvian obligations. I think there's near zero chances that they will say that the pardon is okay as it is. The question for me, more than if it's legal or illegal, it's going to be what is the exact remedy that the court is going to choose. And that is where it gets interesting from a political point of view, because one alternative is that it does what it has sometimes done with either trials that have no due process or amnesty laws, where it says, okay, these laws have no legal effect for me. This trial should be retried. And therefore, in that case, we don't really know what would happen with Fujimori if he be taken back to prison. Or will it just say, Peru, you're violating your obligations under the judgment, and therefore I will let it for you to decide under your domestic law what you should do to fix this impunity situation. So under that scenario, rather than just throwing Fujimori back in jail, Peru would have to demonstrate to the court that the pardon was actually humanitarian, and if it cannot do it, it would have to redo it under the specific legislation applicable to transitional justice, to humanitarian law. And so that would be interesting to see how that affects the political landscape, because it would be a redo. So it's either of those two scenarios, and I think it's fascinating to theorize what will happen.
So then that's very interesting. So I guess the question that I have is, there have been plenty of investigations going on about corruption. We know the fate of at least, three former presidents at the moment on corruption scandals. Is the fear that the fallout from this pardon, and notwithstanding whatever the Human Rights Court would do, that there's going to be a slowing down or even an abandoning of real investigation into corruption, all forms of it, not just the Odebrecht, but others as well? Or is that a real fear in Peru now?
First of all, the Fujimorista party is going after the district attorney, Fiscal de la Nación. So there are concerns about what Max said of a party trying to stall investigations. I think that is a warranted fear that might happen. Yes.
Yeah. Sylvie, are there any questions that have been queued up?
Yes, sir. You have a question from Mercedes Arango at the CCA. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much, Max, Alonso, Paola, and to you, Kenneth, for this very interesting presentation. I think it is clear for us that Peru is now very well positioned in the political terms around the world. But despite the fact that after Fujimori left the power, all the presidents are being investigated because of corruption scandals. But one thing also that all of them have in common is that they all maintain a consistent and coherent economic position. They were all open to keep fostering international investment and attracting other companies and countries to invest in Peru. This is something that it was that after the reform, the economic reform that Fujimori installed, helped Peru to position as a good country to do business. So my question is, how all this scandal will affect in the economic field? And do you think it will discourage potential investors to go to do business in Peru? Do you think this is something that won't have a major influence in this aspect?
Before we answer that, Sylvie, are there other questions?
Not at this time, sir.
Okay. I think we touched a little bit, Mercedes, on that question. The idea is, will all of this upheaval now affect economically, the economic program going forward? Paola, did you want to comment any further on that issue?
Talk about that, and I just last week the finance minister in Peru, Claudia Cooper, said that the political problem will affect the economic growth in this year, because they are expecting the height of the copper, the price of the copper, and we are expecting this push to get better better numbers, that says that the political problems could affect the growth this year.
Okay. Alonso or Max, did you want to comment, make another comment on?
Sure.
I'm back. I apologize. I got disconnected for some reason. I didn't get to hear the entire question, but as I understand it, it relates to how all the presidents follow the same economic policy.
Yes.
Right. So, again, if I don't answer this as a question, since I didn't hear it all, please let me know. But yeah, the all the presidencies after Fujimori followed the same, we say, like the same economic model based on privatization and private initiative, free trade. And the main problem is that, the main exception would be maybe the initial years of the Umala government and some sporadic attempts by the Umala government to strengthen some public companies, especially the petrol company, the oil company. But generally, he was funneled, forced into following the autopilot that Max was talking about. The problem with that is that, in terms of government, the last time that we had a major reform of our institutions or was the signing of the Free Trade Agreement, and those reforms with the United States, and those reforms were basically done to facilitate the existence of the trade agreement. They were not meant to fix the problems of the country. So, for example, we still have a very failed justice system. It is very difficult for everyday citizens to be able to obtain justice. We don't have a Senate, and I think if anything, this crisis has shown us that we need a Senate. And we still don't have a very coherent education policy. We have too many low-paid teachers in public schools. So there's many issues that need tending, but we don't tend to them because they are politically expensive for the presidents, and they would rather just do short-term politically healthy policies than this massive reform campaign. And I agree, but I think that's the problem. That's something that should change quickly.
Okay. Could I just
yeah,
add
Max,
to that?
Please.
Fact of the extraordinary consistency of economic policies of a variety of different governments over the past sort of nearly two decades is one of the great puzzles in the academic literature, and there are a couple of contending theories that explain this. One is an argument that's been made most strongly by Francisco Durand and Jonathan Crabtree, which is that the state is weak and has been captured by powerful entrepreneurial groups. The other argument says it's not the capture of the state, it's actually the power of technocrats within the state that have guaranteed this consistency to policy. So that's, I think, an interesting discussion. And one of the common conditions for either one of those arguments is the relative weakness of civil society. And when I say the relative weakness of civil society, by that I mean that on the one hand, Peru is a country with extraordinary social conflict. There's, at any point in time across the country, numerous conflicts at the local level. What we don't see is those being articulated into a coherent challenge to the economic model. And so if we sort of think about what's going on today, I think one of the things that if I were an investor, I would be thinking about is what does the erosion of the democratic legitimacy of a government mean for the situation? Peru, as I said, is a country that often experiences flashpoints of violent conflict. But the fact that the government has the legitimacy of representing the voters, the will of the voters, and of generating relatively high levels of economic growth, has, I think, immunized it to some degree against the potential destabilizing effects of that. So both an erosion of the sort of economic performance and of the legitimacy of the government, I think, could very well change this situation in ways that could be, over the medium term, potentially destabilizing.
Thank you very much, Max. We're at 1 o'clock right now. Sylvie, if there are no other questions, I guess that's a question. Are there other questions?
Not at this time, sir.
Okay. With that, then I think we'll keep to our promise to end this, make this strictly a 1 hour conference. I really want to thank Alonso, Paola, and Max for your very insightful comments. Clearly, what's going on in Peru now is there's far from being out of the woods on any of this. And as we understand it, there could be more shoes to drop in the short term and at least in the medium term as well. So we'll keep monitoring the situation and convene another Peru program when we think there will be changes when we see changes happening on the ground. Thank you very much for everybody's participation. Thank you very much. Bye now.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does indeed conclude your conference call for today. Once again, thank you for attending. And at this time, we do ask that you please disconnect your lines. Enjoy the rest of your day.